We're in the middle of Egaris Hatshuva, chapter 2. We are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines from the bottom. First word, va'achshav, in English. It's on page 347 today, next to the last paragraph. He said in the last chapter, he gave the definitions of tshuva as being a zivas hachet, going away from tshuva, going away from sin and resolving to do good, and discuss the various different level types of tshuva for positive commandments and negative commandments, serious negative commandments. And in the beginning of chapter 2, he talked about the idea of kapara. Tshuva is something that we do, and kapara is something that Hashem does. Tshuva is, we want to get him close, and kapara says, okay, I'm forgiving the sins. And then, so in order to facilitate the kapara, the atonement, which is to get Hashem back on, to get up back on Hashem's good side. So during temple times, we offered sacrifices for us, for a shogeg, there was a chatas, and for various different ashamais and oilais, these type of things that were offered in order as a vehicle for reestablishing this relationship with Hashem. So he says, that's all in temple times. Now he's going to talk about now, so what do we do now? And again, I'm giving the caveat that not to do anything that it says in this chapter until we get to chapter 12.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned, yes. So don't do anything at all that it says in Egaris Hatshuva, because now he's going to talk about fasting. Wow. Okay? And our generation, he even says this, in our generation, we don't fast.
His generation didn't fast.
And his generation, it was some people fasted.
Okay.
And you still had people who were like these Purushim that would sit a week. They would sit from Sunday until Friday. They would sit and they would learn in a closet someplace in a shul. And they wouldn't eat anything a whole day. They would have, and what they ate at night was just a little bit of something. Okay. And they were sitting and they were learning. Okay, nowadays, so doing such a thing is unheard of. Wow. I don't know anybody who would be able to do such a thing, to be able to sit and not eat anything a whole day and go home at night and have some bread and some water and go to sleep and start the whole thing over the next day and do this continuously. But in those days, so they had people who had that. We don't have the strength to do that. We don't have the inclination, nor do we have the feeling or the need actually to do it. Okay? And for some people, it might be better off for them. We'd like to decrease in our flesh and fat and blood by fasting, as he talks about over here, is why a fast is like a carbon, but it's not for us to get involved with fasting. But we're still going to learn about it because this is tshuva. The first chapters are talking about tshuva according to the Gemara. V'achshav she'ein lana karban. Nowadays that we don't have the vehicle for offering up a sacrifice. And if you went so far as to say, listen, I really want to get on God's good side, so I'm going to build an altar in my backyard and I'm going to offer sacrifices on it, it would be a very big problem. Because not only would the guy have to do atonement for the stuff that he did wrong that he's trying to make amends for, but he'd have to make amends for making the sacrifices in his backyard.
Yeah. No private altars.
And even if he went to the base of Mikdash, now's not the time for such things. We have to wait for Mashiach to come. So, that we don't have now this vehicle of karbonus for changing the will of Hashem, which is an interesting thing, that he says this idea that the sacrifice or the tshuva in this case, or the tainus, is going to change the will of Hashem, is a very perplexing statement, because we have a pasuk in Tehillim that says Ani Hashem Lo Shinisi, I Hashem don't change. Hashem is not going to be motivated, spurred on, or encouraged by anything that we do. Hashem is not into barbecue. That's not what the sacrifices are all about. Oh man, the guy offered me some barbecue. Oh yeah, I'm going for it. Yeah. Nuh-uh. Sorry. Even though it seems like, if you just read very superficially throughout the Tanakh, you have the whole reason why we have rainbows is because Noah came out of the ark, out of the Teva, and he offered up a couple of sacrifices, and God said, doesn't get any better than this. I'm never going to destroy the world again because of a couple of cows and some sheep. You know, so it's not we're not changing Hashem, because that implies a corporeality of Hashem. It implies a superficiality of Hashem.
Like he's like us, like he's motivated by...
Yeah, it seems like we're anthropomorphizing Hashem. Because what's going to be, it says, okay, if this would be the scenario that the sacrifice is, what's going to...
I have no idea how the mechanics of a korban...
The sacrifice is going to change Hashem's mind. Did we not discuss the mechanisms of korban?
No, not really, and that's why it's still confusing.
Okay, you look at the word korban. Okay, Hashem is not changing. We'll probably answer both questions here. Hashem is not changing. The korban is to bring you close. The word korban is from the word karav, meaning to come close.
We did cover it.
And what is causing the distance is not Hashem. What's causing the distance between you and Hashem is you.
Yeah.
Okay, so what the korban does is it takes away the interpositions that exist between, that get in the way of your relationship with Hashem. You have, for example, a person has to go to a mikveh. A woman has to go to mikveh. A man during temple times has to go to mikveh when it was a mitzvah to do it. So they have to do a chafifa first. You have to wash yourself to remove any intervening substances.
Yeah.
So that the mikveh will have its effect. If there's something on the person's body that gets in the way of the water, so the mikveh is no mikveh. So with the karbanos, so what the person wants to do is they want to be immersed in godliness, but they got this schmutz that is blocking their connection to Hashem. And so what do they have to do is they have to get it off. And the carbon acts as that medium for removing the schmutz from the person's neshama. As it says, the prophet Jeremiah said that, Yeshaya said, "Afila mechitza shel barzel ein mavdilin bein bnei Yisrael v'avicham shebishamayim," that even iron curtains do not separate between the Jews and Hashem. Avol is the rest of the pasuk. Aseinim mavdilim, their sins separate. And what? Because how? It's not that Hashem says, "Oh, I hate you. You're disgusting. Get out of here." What you did?
We want to walk away.
You're terrible. You know what we're doing is we're the one who pushed ourselves away and put up a block between us. Hashem wants to give us flow, but we've put up this block. We're clogging the channels. You remember we talked in chapter 1 that the word chait means a dent, and avera means to move over, to transgress. You know, so we're the one that's messing things up. So it's the carbon that kind of cleans things out, smooths things over. So it's not that Hashem's will is getting turned back. Hashem says, Hashem says, "When will my children come back to me already?" And Hashem is sitting and waiting. Hashem hasn't moved. Okay? It's us that have done the moving. And like this, that when Hashem wants to give us, but Hashem can't give us because we're putting up a block. When we remove the block, then that which Hashem wants to give us can now be given to us. Now there's a point. There's no point in giving it if we can't receive it, so He doesn't give it to us. So like this, now that when a person corrects it, at that time it was through doing us, through offering sacrifices. But now, he says, "Hatainis huva makom karban." The fasting takes the place of a sacrifice. That what happens when a person fasts, they decrease their fat and blood. What is it that a person offers on the Mizbeach? Fat and blood. So in essence, therefore, that which a person is doing by fasting is taking their own fat and blood and putting it on an altar for Hashem. Shizvat ki'ilu hikrafti lefanecha. That because now a person, ideally what happens, a person is going to fast, so he's going to lose weight. And his losing weight is going to be his offering up of a sacrifice. What is he sacrificing? He's sacrificing his own flesh and blood, his own fat and blood. Okay, again, we reiterate that even though he's now recommending that if you want to offer up a sacrifice, it's a very good thing to fast, but in our time, we don't. I believe I told this story. There was a bacher who, when I was learning in Morristown, he went to a non-Lubavitcher yeshiva, Balachuva yeshiva first. And he decided he's going to go yeshiva shopping. And he, you know, checked it out. Is the yeshiva that I'm in really the best one for me? And so he shopped around. He decided he's going to stick around Morristown for a while. And he wrote the Rebbe the things that he was doing, the differences between the two yeshivas, and the different things that he did, and which things from the other yeshivas should he keep, as they were considered good things and things for piety and holiness that they did, their seder avodah that they had in that yeshiva. But they don't do in Lubavitcher yeshivas, and should he observe, switch to Nusahari, this type of stuff. A whole long letter that he wrote the Rebbe, and the Rebbe answered him a whole long reply. And when it came to the idea, one of the things that he wrote is that they have a custom in this yeshiva is that they fast Mondays and Thursdays. Yeah. In order to, I've told you this story?
I know the concept, like the
Yeah, 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 a lot of people do it.
Yeah.
You fast Monday and Thursday, every Monday, Thursday, not just Bahab, but every Monday, Thursday, they fast. A half day fast, whatever.
A daytime fast, yeah.
Okay? The purpose of being is that you learn how to break your body and control yourself, and you're in charge, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so the Rebbe answered, put a line through it, crossed it out, and said, he wrote, I don't even remember the exact expression that he wrote, but he says, counterproductive.
Counterproductive?
Counterproductive.
He just went, wow. Counterproductive.
He wrote counterproductive, and then he explained, because when a person is going to fast, so when they get done with the fast at night, because they fasted, they now have an excuse to go eat more than they would have eaten if they hadn't fasted. Person thought to himself, I didn't eat a whole day today. I'm fasting. I'm so hungry. So instead of eating the 1,200 calories, he's going to eat 1,600 calories to make up that he's hungry for that much long. And second of all, he's not going to be able to concentrate because he's fasting. Now he's got an excuse. I'm fasting, so now I can't learn. The Alter Rebbe calls such a person a sinner in the next page. And the Rebbe said, or answered, if you would like to control yourself and break your body, what you should do, rather than fast on Mondays and Thursdays, is, as it's suggested in the Shulchan Aruch, is leave the last mouthful on the plate. Because even though you want to eat it, and it's sitting there, and you know, we have this idea that if you leave food on your plate, it's a sin. All that kind of stuff. China. This thing has been like bred into our
starving China.
And yeah, the starving children in Biafra, right? Exactly, the whole business. So he says, but it's going to show that you're in control. And technically speaking, according to Shulchan Aruch, that's what it says you're supposed to do, as an indication that you trust that Hashem is going to give you your next meal, that you don't have to clean your plate with this meal. It's considered genteel to leave over the last mouthful on the plate. Okay? It's Derech Eretz. This is what the Rebbe suggested to him. So he once said, I wish I had never told the Rebbe about my fasting on Monday and Thursday. Because it's easier to fast on Monday and Thursday than to leave the last mouthful on the plate. Because you can understand, if you're not doing it, you're not doing it. I'm removed from it. I don't have my mind on it. But here you are, you're in the middle of it, and you have to stop yourself in the middle. Okay.
So I wanted to mention a certain rabbi that I know also talked about this, and he said that when somebody gets into the habit of fasting, it can create like a almost like a false sense of like spirituality, almost like a
totally,
you know, almost like, oh, I'm so elevated, I'm so
sense of pride.
Yeah,
it creates a sense of arrogance. Yeah. Indeed, there are a zillion Baal Shem Tovs. Zillion Baal Shem Tov stories where a guy fasted for so many fasts, and the Rebbe just, you know, the Baal Shem Tov just basically, you know, the one that comes immediately to mind is a person fasted 40 fasts, and it says in the books that if you fast 40 fasts consecutively, you're going to see Eliyahu.
Right.
Okay? And here it is, he shows up to the Baal Shem Tov's house, and he's wearing white clothes, and he's fasting, and he doesn't talk Lashon Hara, and you know, he rolls in the snow, and he's not seeing Eliyahu. So he came to the Baal Shem Tov. He heard the Baal Shem Tov was a big hoo-ha rabbi. He wanted to know, why isn't he not seeing Eliyahu? So when he came to the Baal Shem Tov, and Mrs. Baal Shem Tov answered the door, he said, he's out back in the stable. He says, the Rebbe's in the stable? What kind of business? A Rebbe in the stable? So he went, he saw the Rebbe was patting, the Baal Shem Tov was patting a horse, saying, oh, you're such a good horse. You're such a good horse. So the guy's looking at him, says, oh, okay, hello, just a second. He pats his horse, oh, you're such a good horse. Anyway, so as they're walking back to the house, the Baal Shem Tov says, you're probably wondering why I was patting the horse like that. He said, yeah. He said, you should know that this horse wears white, it's a white horse, it's snow, this horse rolls in the snow, this horse never speaks Lashon Hara. Okay? And this horse is still a horse. Okay, so it is a vehicle. So when a person can do such a thing, it is a vehicle for developing one's own pride, you might say. Okay, now there are instances. There's other things that where pride is what do you call it? It's a trick of the Yetzer Hara to get a person not to do something. There's a famous story that in the 50s, Lubavitcher Bachram used to go to shuls on Shabbos. They still go to shuls on Shabbos in New York. They walk from 7 to 7, they walk to different neighborhoods. Now there's more Jewish neighborhoods than there were probably in the 50s now. And this one Bachram had yechidus with the Rebbe, and he said he doesn't want to go to the shuls because when he chazers chassidus, he feels very proud of himself. And he's worried he's going to become a bal gaiva. He's going to become an arrogant person. So the Rebbe told him, you should become an onion, but you still have to go into shuls and chazer chassidus. Now, it sounds very funny. I don't care what you become. Go become an onion. I'm afraid I'm going to become arrogant. Yeah, go become an onion. You know, why did the Rebbe say you should become an onion? Is it because there's a famous Yiddish curse. There's al vaksana zoviat sibyl. You should grow like an onion, and cup in the air, and the feet in the luft, with your head in the ground and the feet in the air. Okay, that's the famous. Everybody's heard that. No, you never heard that one.
Yeah, just teach me.
Yeah. That's.
Put this in here.
Thank
you. Yeah, has it been? Lachem mitzina kama tenoim v'amarayim. Therefore, we see, look in the Gemara, Sha'al davar kal hayam is'anin tainis harbim ma'oid. That for some little insignificant thing,
Thomas Strauss, I remember, is that?
They fasted a zillion things.
What?
Whoa.
They've been fasted a zillion times, yeah.
That's a heavy number.
Zillions of fasts, these guys. For example, let's see. I don't know. It doesn't even give numbers how much they fasted. Okay.
Yeah, the straps. That's one. I turned the page.
Yeah. Shekholm is silent. For example, Kamai Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Shahamatish Shetehei Parasa. There was an argument in the Gemara in Masechta Shabbos, and Masechta B'meh Behema Yatsis, in the Gemara that talks about carrying, because your animals also have to rest on Shabbos. You cannot put a whole lot of stuff, everything that you need for Shabbos to go to shul, put it on your beast of burden, and have the animal walk to shul, and you're not carrying anything. No, you're not allowed to do that because it says Livhem Techa. Your animals also have to rest.
Right. They can only take what they need.
Right. So now, so there's a discussion about a basically would be what we call a leash on an ox. Okay,
dog.
That this thing is, well, the dog is different. This is a thing that they would wrap around a couple of times around the ox's horns,
right, the horns,
so that they'd be able to schlep the ox along. Okay, so the Chachamim Eisrin. The Chachamim said that's called carrying. The rule is, just like the same with people, you're allowed to wear clothes, but you're not allowed to carry articles.
Right.
So there's a whole discussion of what's called normal wearing and what's called carrying, which would be abnormal wearing. Like, for example, your glasses you're allowed to wear because we call that wearing eyeglasses. We don't call that carrying eyeglasses.
Right.
If you're going to put your eyeglasses on top of your forehead, so that's called carrying them.
Right.
Okay? To tie things off of your belt is called carrying. To wear clothes, wear shoes, he talks about gartels, you're allowed to wear 18 gartels on 18 different parts of your clothing.
Hmm.
That was a really...
Okay. Because you have to talk about one on each sleeve, and one on each sock, and one on each pant leg, and around your waist, and around your shirt, around your vest, et cetera, around your neck, your tie, you know. You're doing like an Arab over there, on the top over there. And so you can technically, you can wear up to 18 gartels.
Uh-huh.
Does anybody do it for religious reasons?
No. But you do have people, for example, that when they go to mikveh will wrap a towel around their waist where they're not wearing a gartel. So that's the way that they get to be able to carry a towel to the mikveh because they're wearing the towel.
Okay.
So, and people do it in Crown Heights all over the place.
Yeah, here.
You know?
I've seen it down here. Yeah.
You wear a scarf around your neck. You know? You just kind of wrap the thing around and that's it. It's, you know?
Right.
Right. So if you wore your talus like that, like you wear a scarf, that would be called carrying because it's not normal for you to wear a talus like that. A talus has to be draped over your shoulders.
Right.
Okay. And then there's the deal with what about women and jewelry?
Yeah.
Okay. Women wear jewelry.
Right.
But...
playing with fire.
You can't tell a lady, no, I'm sorry, you can't go out with without your jewelry on. No. So, but there was a whole big thing before the advent of the code alarms, the code locks.
So
the keys. What are you gonna do? How do you carry your keys? And there was a whole thing in Crown Heights when I first became religious, is women were getting their front door keys gold plated,
right?
And it had a pin attached to the back of it so that they could wear their pin.
Nice bracelet or something.
Well, they wear the pin.
Yeah.
A pin right on their lapel, like a lapel pin.
Like you could wear it to a wedding.
Yeah. So that's actually the criteria. The rabbi came out and said, if the only reason why you're wearing this is so that you can wear your front door key, guess what? That's called carrying. If you would wear this key to a wedding, so then it's a piece of jewelry.
So I wear my belt to my wedding. I wear my key to my wedding, to weddings.
Okay. Well, fine. Good. So now, there's a whole chapter in Gemara about animals, what they wear. Okay? A donkey is allowed to have a blanket because donkeys are cold a whole year. Even it says, "Betak fiditamus chamrakarza." In the middle of the summertime, a donkey is shivering. I don't know what's up with their metabolism over there. I'm not into animal husbandry. I don't know, but I just know what it says in the Gemara. Huh. So for a donkey to wear a blanket, that's fine.
Huh.
For your dog in the summertime to be wearing a blanket is called carrying.
Yeah.
Because dogs don't need blankets in summertime.
That's called animal abuse.
Yeah, okay.
I like to know, because there's a halacha that can't let the leash touch the ground. So I read it, and I'm like, I don't know why, but I'm like, okay, the leash won't touch the ground, I don't leave the dog. But I know, when I studied Shabbos, I never saw the dog.
You live in an area where there's an Arab, there's no problem anyway.
And I use the Arab, but just in case I don't drag the dog.
Right, so.
But...
So so there's a whole discussion about the all the implements on a cow, the bell and the straps, and this, you know, if you put stirrups on it, or you know, if you ride the thing, a saddle, these type of things, you know, all this type of stuff.
That's covered in the Shemot.
So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said that you're allowed to have a leash on wrapped around the horns of your ox for schlepping purposes. Because otherwise, how are you going to schlep an ox? You know how big an ox is?
Yeah.
You're talking, this is...
ox will schlep you.
Yeah, you're talking many hundred pounds of pot roast in movable form. Mm.
If you're talking about a true ox, it dwarfs a bull.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're talking about a true ox.
Yes. You know. Yeah, 1,000 pounds? Yeah.
Yeah, categorized by the horns.
Real ox? Come again. Probably closer to 1,500 or 1,600 pounds.
Right. So you're not. I got this for you. The little strap around his horns. You're not going to schlep the thing anyway.
Yeah. You know that's why they act. You know that's why they put the steel ring through their nose. So because they twist it, and that will make that bull do anything you want it to.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's why they put the ring to control it. Just a little twist in
there. Right, I know a lot of guys that are like that. Have a little ring in it. Yeah. Like, just grab it.
Exactly. You know, that's little, and I'll do whatever fetch. She
it
says.
Can't be very big.
That's right. Yes. Indeed.
I don't need a ring. I'm already
right. It's a figurative ring. Anyway, so this is all being recorded.
Yeah.
So
it's true.
So Elizabeth has already said, I don't see that as being carrying. I see that as being wearing. The Chachamim said you're not allowed to. Because why are you schlepping this ox on Shabbos? Yeah. What purpose do you have in schlepping the thing?
Right, right, right.
This is not a Shabbos-dick thing to do.
Right.
And therefore, the ox does not need to get the leash on it.
Right.
Pam achas yotze ben parasa bayotze kein parasa shel shantai v'loy michabo. One time it happened that he sees the ox of his neighbor is walking around out on Shabbos, and it's got a strap around its neck, and he didn't go over to his neighbor and say, hey, the halacha is that you're not allowed to have your ox doing that.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Silence.
Meaning he said he was basically sticking to his guns.
Yeah, he wasn't in support of his friends. Yeah.
Right. V'hushkar shina mivnei atzamit asher lo kayim divrei chaverav. His teeth became black because of the number of fasts that he assumed upon himself that he did for the reason of not fulfilling the words of his friend. Not that he was upset about the fact of somebody may have been Mechol Shabbos, because who was being Mechol Shabbos was the cow. Okay, you're told your cow should rest too. And if your cow happens to go out and be Mechol Shabbos somehow, so the cow's not being Mechol Shabbos.
Yeah, how's the cow? I mean, the cow didn't put strap on.
Correct. Well, the cow, maybe the strap was on from yesterday already.
Okay. All right, that'll buy.
Okay.
Okay.
So, but he should have, but it was not because of the Chil Shabbos that was involved.
Right,
that's
right.
Why he fasted.
But because
it was because of his attitude.
Right, because of that.
I believe, Rebbe, you know, who are we talking about? We're talking about Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah. Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah was the one who said, Hari Ani Keben Shivim Shana. I'm like a 70-year-old, as it says in the base, and we have by Haggadah.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And the Rebbe brings down it's not the Arizal, some other Makuba, I don't remember right now. That in actuality, Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah, who was only 18 years old, was an incarnation of Shmuel HaNavi, who lived to be 52 years old. And the 52 years of Shmuel and the 18 years of Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah equals 70. And that's why he, at age 18, he was pointed the head of the Sanhedrin.
And could say with honesty,
I'm like a 70-year-old.
Right, yeah.
Okay? That he had the wisdom of a 70-year-old.
Right.
Okay? And he was a humble enough a person to say, listen, I know what the halacha is. The halacha is that you're supposed to say the parsha of Shema at night. The parsha of Tzitzis at night. Right? That's the whole thing in the Haggadah. Elo zechish yitamim, you know, Yitzias Mitzrayim b'laylah. Why was all discussion? Is because the whole mitzvah of Yitzias Mitzrayim is contained within the parsha that talks about tzitzis. So we're going to base it on the expression davar alamid minyanei. If you use a juxtaposition, contextually speaking, So it talks about tzitzis, and tzitzis are only during the day. And that's the main focus of that portion that we say, the third paragraph of the Shema. And it happens also to mention the mitzvah that you're supposed to remember that you left Egypt. So you're going to say, just like it is, that tzitzis is during the day. So to also, this mentioning that you left Egypt should also be during the day.
Right.
Okay? And Rabbi Elizabeth Azariah is the head of the academy. And he's trying to push forth a halacha. This is when we have halacha really concretizing, solidifying.
Right.
And he said, I really knew what the halacha was. Listen, I've been doing this for my whole life. God talked to me when I was 8 years old, and I remember 1,000 years ago.
Wow.
And I know the halacha is supposed to be, but I don't have a way of proving it until Ben Zoma came and he made the whole drush over there, etc., etc. So now he's really pretty set in his understanding of halacha.
Yeah, fairly so.
He pretty much knows his stuff. And between you and me, if Rabbi Elizabeth Azariah told me I could or couldn't do something, I'm going to feel confident following
much,
what he says.
Pretty much stick with that, huh?
Okay, so here it is that wow. Because there are certain rules in how do we render halachic decisions. And even though he personally believed that it's no problem for this animal to walk around like that with the strap around its horns, he had to acquiesce and say, yeah, there's only one Judaism,
right.
And there's only one halacha, and there's only one way to do this,
right.
And that's to follow the chachamim.
Right.
Okay? That's one instance he brings. Then, he says, the Cain of Yoshua. This is a very, I don't want to say obscure, arcane, but this is a really wild example. You have Rabbi Yoshua. Okay, Rabbi Yoshua was the head of the Sanhedrin in his time. Rabbi Elazar was the head of the Reish Galusa, was the head of he was the Nasi, and Rabbi Yoshua was the head of the Beis Din. And he's like Mr. Man in charge over here. Okay? Sha'amar bushani mit bedrechem Beis Shammai. He said, Beis Shammai, what your logic embarrasses me. V'hushchur shinim mivnei hatzaymas. And he too, he fasted so much so until his teeth turned black. Okay, one of the ways that we know, just the idea of turning black, with teeth turning, what's his idea? You know, if you've ever come across, met anybody who was anorexic,
you only have to be
you're talking
starving.
Yeah, you're talking starving.
Starving to death.
Yes.
Okay. Or the body can't eat anymore because you're past the point of being able to die.
Right. Exactly. That's what the way these guys, you know, nowadays that we would we put these people into emergency wards.
Yeah, put them in a hospital.
Get them
tie them up.
Get them some good, you know, counseling, right. And tell them, you know, it's okay. You can like your body the way it is, and stop looking in the mirror and all that kind of stuff. Yes. Okay. What was the deal with Rabbi Yoshua? There was an argument. It's in Masechta Chagiga, and it concerns a side point. It has nothing to do really with Chagiga. It has to deal with the sacrifices that were brought on Yantif. That's what a Korban Chagiga is. Okay, so there's an argument, there's a discussion over there as to whether an earthenware pot will protect against tumas oil. What do you have? If you have a person, a dead body in a house,
right?
Everything in the house, under the roof, becomes tame.
Right.
With the exception of things that are inside sealed earthenware pots.
Right. Sealed.
Sealed.
Yes.
Because the outside of an earthenware pot does not become tummy. Only things that would come on the inside, if the pot is open, so the inside of the pot becomes tummy. But if it's got a seal on it, then it protects, it interposes between the tumma and the impurity and whatever is inside that pot. So there's a discussion concerning the earthenware pots of an Amma Aretz. An Amma Aretz in this situation is referred to a person who's not careful about ritual impurity. Like, for example, all of us sitting around this table right now.
Exactly.
We would all be considered Amma Aretzim.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, because none of us are careful about ritual impurity.
No.
So, but then there's a discussion over there as to the contents of the pots inside of those people. Okay? And Beis Shammai says that the earthenware pot is only taher for the Am Haaretz himself. But for you or me, it would be considered impure. Okay, wow. This is the way Beis Shammai paskens.
Hmm. Okay.
So Rabbi Yoshua stood up and said, "Bushani Beis Shammai mitzvareichem. I am embarrassed," and gives this whole big kal v'chaimer with a woman who's a nida and a kneading trough, and she's on the top floor, and you have the impurity on the lower floor. Gives this whole long argument to prove his point. And then somebody from Beis Shammai just gave a very simple example of how their logic could be correct. Even though halacha is not like them, but they gave a very simple proof how their logic is going to be correct. So it says at that moment, so Rabbi Yoshua went to all of the graves of the members of Beis Shammai and prostrated on them and asked forgiveness and fasted until his teeth turned black. Simply because he came up with this expression, "I'm embarrassed from your words," meaning you guys are a bunch of
how could you possibly think
you guys are a bunch of morons is basically right, what he was right, saying, and this happens to be one of the interesting things, which is it's a hard thing to explain to somebody who doesn't learn Gemara, doesn't appreciate the holiness of the Gemara, is the expression "Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chayim." Both opinions in the Gemara are correct. People have problems processing that because, what do you mean? This guy says you could, this guy says you can't. How could they both be right? And the answer is in the grand scheme, it's not black or white. It's not, we're not dealing in binary numbers over here where it's on or off. We have circumstances, we have situations, we have time periods, and they're both the will and wisdom of Hashem. And we'll even go so far as to say, if you look at the Gemara, two-thirds of the Gemara are questions. And the questions are also Torah.
Right.
If you wanted to throw out all the questions from the Gemara, what would you have? You'd have a Shulchan Aruch.
Right.
Okay? And it would save a whole lot of time. Okay? So, but why is it they keep it in? Because this is also part of the Torah. The question itself is part of Torah. Okay, so Rabbi Yoshua was a statue. This is a person who was a leader of the Jewish people. And it really is beneath him to use such a grub expression like, "I'm embarrassed from your words, Beis Shammai."
Yeah.
This is a person of a Rebbish stature that you would think would have, the expression is that Divrei Chachamim Benachas Nishmayim. The words of a Talmud Chacham are a pleasure to listen to, but the word benachas nishmoyim can also be translated as are heard with pleasantness, meaning that they're always talking in a pleasant manner.
Right.
And here he comes up with such a statement like this. He said, "Oh man, I blew it big time."
Yeah.
Okay, and he fasted. Okay, then we got one more. If that wasn't enough, the Rav Huna happened with Rav Huna. Pam achas nahavchal ritzur shel tefillin v'hisan mem tzaymos. It once happened that the strap of his tefillin shel rosh, the one that goes around the head from the front of the head to the knot, not the thing that hangs down,
but the fat,
the within the knot. No, the one that's on the head itself.
Right.
Okay, flipped over. If your ritzua that's hanging over in front of your chest flips over, what do?
You flip it back. You put it back.
Yeah. This okay. You can't see is the point.
You can't see because it's on your head.
Right.
Okay, I know my mother used to have eyes in the back of her head, but you know.
You're talking about the one that comes down.
It's the one that goes
No, right not this. The one that comes down.
Oh, the one that's on your head.
Your head.
Not so round to the back.
From, yeah. That goes okay. From between the tartura, from the head, where the tefillin goes through, the strap goes through right, the tefillin, to the knot.
To the knot, right.
And that on one time, that the side of it turned over.
Right.
Okay? So he felt so bad that such a thing like this happened, that his tefillin turned over, that he fasted 40 fasts. to, because it showed an imperfection on him. Did such a thing ever happen to you?
Well, this is his way of reaching his pocket.
Between you and me,
I didn't fast forward for it.
I probably wouldn't know until someone told me.
Since I learned this 37 years ago, it's never happened to me that my tefillin, I went like this and said, "Oh, my tefillin are like, you know, oh, what's this all about?" It doesn't happen. The reason that it happened to him, there must be something he's indicating. Man, I've got some kind of shortcoming going on over here. I've got to do some heavy correcting.
Yeah. Okay. This is equivalent to saying reaching his pocket, get the wrong change.
Yeah. This is a Rav Huna who spoke regularly with Eliyahu on a regular basis.
Right.
Okay. So, like you said, yeah. If tomorrow, because now this it hasn't happened in 37 years, tomorrow I'm going to put on my tefillin, in the middle of Asher, I'm going to go Paseach Es Yedecha, and my hand's going to hit my Ritzua, and it's going to say, "Oh, it's upside down," and I'm going to flip it back over, and I'm going to say, "Must be a Lechol Chai Ratzon," and you know, do the rest of it, and keep going.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not even going to think. I'm going to think about twice about it. I'm not even going to think once about it.
Yeah.
Okay. But for him, it does now, and then he says. And there's lots of stories like this in the Gemara. So now the question comes. Why does the Alter Rebbe choose three stories to exemplify a point about Tannoim and Amoraim that fasted, a lot of fasts, for something that we would consider serious, insignificant things? He could have written it. The Alter Rebbe could have written it. The Alter Rebbe was very exact in writing Ageras Hatshuva as well. He could have said, "Lachen mitzina kama tanoim emarayim shal davar kal misan in tainis harbe ma'oid v'kehena rabbis," or something like that. There are many instances where we see tanoim and amarayim fasting, lots of fasts for small things. You have to remember when the Alter Rebbe originally wrote the Tanya, I'm not sure how far reaching the Alter Rebbe's foresight was into who was going to be studying the Tanya. But from what I'm led to believe, the Alter Rebbe didn't really think that people were going to be sitting around somebody's living room drinking tea and casually discussing the matters that were discussed in Tanya. He was thinking more like the Wolf Kisses and the Shmuel Munkuses and the Yosef Kolboys.
Right.
And these are people who, as soon as you say, "Oh, there's lots of stories about rabbis in the Talmud who fasted lots of times," they would be able to rattle you off every single one of them.
Right.
So he didn't have to write down these stories for them to let them know that which story it was. And if you're going to tell me, why write Kehena Rabbis, that there's lots of these stories, just suffice it, just write one story. All I have to do is just tell me about this whole thing with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Okay? Or even less, you know, tell me this one thing about Rav Huna. He fasted 40 times. Maybe you want to say, okay, his teeth didn't turn black. From 40 fasts, his teeth did not turn black. Okay? So you want to bring in something more serious. So bring in the stories where that guy's teeth turned black and he was, you know, you can say, and he didn't mention anything about being Mishtatek al Kivrei Beit Shammai. That he doesn't bring in. That he went and he felt so bad that he prostrated himself on the graves of Beit Shammai. Okay? That stuff he doesn't bring in. So why is it that he does it? Why does the Alter Rebbe bring in specifically these three? Is what was it they were fasting for? You have Rav Elazar ben Azariah. What was it that he was fasting for? An opinion. Is basically what he was fasting about.
Yes.
He was fasting because he thought that the halacha should be such and such.
Correct.
That's why he was fasting. What did Rabbi Yehoshua fast for? Is because he said, "I'm embarrassed by your words."
Thought, speech, and action.
And what did Rav Huna did something wrong by having his strap turn over? So here you have three examples brought as an indication, as Rav Kiva so picked up, as an indication of people whose wrongdoings involve thought, speech, and action.
Mm-hmm.
So you think, you look, what's the big deal? If a person thinks something wrong, did they do something wrong? No.
do something wrong? No,
it's, no, they didn't do something wrong.
Later on, it's worse than doing something wrong, but it's not doing something wrong.
Correct. It's we talked about this corruption in the first part of the Tanya over in chapter 6. Six, seven, and eight, where he talks about, you know, where is it, 15, 14, where he says over there that, for example, a person thought about doing something wrong, but he didn't even think about doing something wrong. He just had a fantasy that he was imagining what would it be if he would be able to do something wrong.
Right. See the pleasure in doing something wrong.
Yeah. Okay, like every Machshava Zora we ever had in davening, yes, for example. So what are those people called in Tanya? They're called Rashas. Okay, so Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, really a person of his stature, to even think something wrong, which it wasn't even a wrong thing, because the halacha hadn't been determined yet. Since he was thinking in this vein, when he should have been, could have been thinking something better. That's what it is in all of these things. You know, which each one of these, each one of these big tzaddikim is, well, they could have been doing something better. And therefore they accepted upon themselves to do these fasts. Okay, why? Because the people of their stature, such a thing that they did would create an interposition between them and God. You ask the question of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu hit the rock the second time instead of speaking to it, and God says, "Oh, that's it, you blew it. Big time. Okay, you're not going in, you're going to die in the desert. You let me down." Okay, what would be if you or I were to stand in front of a rock a second time, smack it, and have water come out of it? You would be on Oprah.
Everybody would call you a tzaddik. Yeah.
Yes. And so what did Moshe do wrong? So so use the example of changing the oil in your car. Okay, have you ever changed the oil in your car?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Did you ever wear your silk kapata when you're changing the oil in your car?
No.
Okay.
No.
Because what would be, you get like a little drop of motor oil on your kapata. Yeah, it's like, oh my goodness.
The
world is coming to an end.
Yes.
Your
oil's on your kapata always.
Yeah. So that's always. Right. And you get a little oil on your old coveralls.
Right.
Big deal.
Yeah, that's what
big deal.
Yeah.
So for me to have my tefillin on my Rochel Roche for the strap to flip over, I'm not even coveralls.
Yeah.
For Moshe Rabbeinu to hit the rock, so that's a speck on a white silk kapata.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very highly noticeable.
Yeah, yeah.
So for these three rabbis, so there was this feeling within themselves that they were on, and this is not, you know, it says that one of the things of a nevus, of humility, of a intrinsic part of humility is that a person has to know their place and stature and know their talents.
Has to know, right.
A person who says, where am I and what am I, that's not humble. That's humiliated, that's called a low life, that's not humble. A humble person says, I know what I can do and I could always be doing better. That's a humble person. So somebody like an Elazar ben Azariah, who knows that he's the head of the Sanhedrin, he wakes up every morning, he goes to work, and he knows that he's not sitting, he's 18 years old, and he knows he's not sitting way up in the back in the bleachers. He's sitting right up in number the chair that's before chair number one.
Right.
Okay, chair number one is for number one student, and he's sitting in the chair before that.
Right.
So he knows where he's supposed to be.
Yeah.
So when he came up with this, when this whole thing happened, so he felt that this caused a very big interposition between him and God. And therefore he felt, I have to do something to get this block out.
Correct.
Between me and God.
Yeah, correct.
And therefore, all of these people fasted this number of fasts. Okay, I'm just going to fly through the rest of it so just we can get done with the chapter. Leimed Harizal, the Talmid of Alpi Chachmas Ha'emes Mispar Hatzumas Lekama Avinus V'Chatayim Avshein Behem Karis V'Loy Mises B'Dei Shemayim. Therefore, based on this premise, the Arizal wrote a whole book about fasting. Every little thing that you got to do, you have to fast a certain number of fasts. Okay, even though they're not even serious. Kamai, for example, akas kufnan alef tainis. Every time you get angry, 151 fasts. Okay?
Black teeth.
Va'afila isid rabbanan kistam yayana. Yisayna ayin gimel tainisim. And even if a person drinks wine, which is only prohibited according to the rabbanan, the wine that you buy, if a person goes into a liquor store now, the chances of it being usir midiraisa is really slim. Because only wine which was actually prepared for and used, prepared for and or used in an idolatrous ritual, is usir midiraisa.
Right.
The wine that we don't buy now because we call it not kosher wine is called stam yayin.
Yeah.
That means wine which wasn't used for anything, but it wasn't supervised properly by a Jew.
Right.
So the Arizal says a person drinks such wine like this, 73 fasts.
Only.
The kain al bitl misses asid the rabbanin kemait fila yisana samach ayin tainuses. If a person misses a shmeina esrei, which is only just a rabbinic enactment, 61 tainusin. How many are we up to already? V'derek klal seida tainus hu segula niflois lihis galus rotsana elyon baruch hu. And generally, we want to say that the esoteric principle behind the fasting is. It's a wonderful present. Thank you very much. It's a wonderful present to reveal the will, that to allow the will of Hashem to reveal itself. Kamaya carbon, just like a sacrifice. Shenamar by Reich Nechaych LaHashem. That about a sacrifice, it says that this is a pleasant spirit to God. Ukamosha Kazab Yeshaya Alazet Tikrit Sum V'yayim Ratzayim LaHashem. He writes over there, and this is going to be called a fast and an auspicious day to Hashem. Miklal shahatzayim hanirtzahu yom ha'ratzon implies that a wanted fast is an auspicious day, that the fasting itself becomes auspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So again, let me reiterate, especially for those who are listening at home, that they shouldn't go and get your copy of the Rizal's book on how to cleanse your soul with all the fasts that you have, because I can guarantee you'll go through it and you won't eat anything for the rest of your life.
Right.
And because it happens now, he's going to ask you at this rate. Because he's going to say, okay, if a person was angry once, 151 times.
Right.
Okay, so how many times has he been angry in his lifetime?
Yeah,
so it's 151 times? Hello?
Yeah.
So you can talk about how to get around that one in chapter 3.
It's enough, 3 times around.
Yeah. You can talk about that, do the 3 times and then redeem the rest. Thank you very much. So you're not going to have a whole lot of money left over.
Right. Exactly.
So the... but I reiterate, don't do anything
at home. Please stay tuned.
Yeah, please stay tuned. Don't do anything at home.
Right.
To be continued.
Yes.